So, imagine for a second you are sitting on 3 million bushels of harvested corn.
That is a lot of corn.
Right. It's like sitting right there in your massive steel silos. And it represents a whole year of just grueling, backbreaking labor.
Oh, yeah.
Plus, millions of dollars in equipment loans. Literally, your family's entire net worth is just sitting in those silos. So you go to sleep feeling pretty secure.
Sure. I mean, you've got the goods.
Exactly. But then overnight, this crazy headline drops about some massive, completely unexpected grain surplus coming out of South America.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. By the time you wake up and, pour your morning coffee, the global price of corn has absolutely plummeted,
Like off a cliff.
just totally tanked. And you have essentially lost half of your net worth before 7 a.m.
That is the ultimate nightmare right there.
It really is. But what if I told you there was a mathematical, ironclad way to make sure that terrifying headline just like doesn't matter to your business at all?
I'd say I want to learn how to do that immediately.
Right. Well, we are going to show you exactly how to build that defense today. But before we get into the actual mechanics of financial survival, just a super quick note. This deep dive is brought to you by Cert Fuel.
Yeah, they're awesome.
If you are grinding through your exam prep right now, I mean, they've got a full Series 3 course with like adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing. Check it out at certfuel.com.
Definitely worth a look if you're taking the Series 3.
For sure. Okay, so let's unpack this. We are tackling a truly massive topic today. Like, if you are listening to this, you are staring down the barrel of the Series 3 exam.
Yeah, you are.
You are training to work with actual commercial clients, futures commission merchants, introducing brokers, commodity pool operators, trading advisors. And to do that, you have to understand the absolute beating heart of the entire commodities world, which is hedging theory.
Yeah, the stakes here are, frankly, they are incredibly high for your exam prep. Like, hedging theory is not just some single chapter you can gloss over.
No, definitely not.
It is literally the fundamental vocabulary of the entire market. I mean, based on the source material we are looking at, part one of your exam spans roughly 71% of the entire test.
Wait, 71%?
71%. That is chapters 1 through 7 combined. And hedging theory runs through like almost every single piece of that. If you don't intimately understand hedging, the rest of the exam is going to look like a completely foreign language.
Wow, okay. That 71% stat is staggering. I mean, it really means you absolutely cannot fake your way through this.
Not a chance.
Like, you can't just memorize a stack of flashcards the night before, learn a few vocabulary words, and hope you can sort of guess your way to a passing score.
No. Which brings us to the most critical ground rule we have to establish right out of the gate here. The test writers are smart. Like, really smart.
Oh, yeah, they know exactly what they're doing.
They do. The exam tests your logical reasoning. It does not test your rote memorization. They're going to throw these highly specific, really weird hypothetical scenarios at you.
Like stuff you've never seen before.
Exactly. They will change the variables. They'll invent entirely new industries. They will flip the timelines around. And if you try to, like, memorize every possible combination of if this happens, then I do that, your brain will literally melt and you will fail.
Yeah, you just can't brute force it.
Right. But if you understand the why, and by that I mean specifically understanding the underlying cash position of the hedger and the deepest, darkest economic fears that are keeping them awake at night, well, then you can logically derive the correct futures action every single time.
Even if it's a totally bizarre scenario you've never practiced.
Exactly. The logic always holds up.
Okay, so that is our mission today. For you listening right now, we're going to make this stick. We are going to drill it. We're going to flip it upside down. And we are going to repeat it until you can literally answer these questions in your sleep.
That's the goal.
We are building a mental framework that is completely bulletproof, especially if you're like me and your ADHD means standard textbook reading just puts you right to sleep.
Right. We need to keep this moving.
Yeah, so we're going to use humor, we're going to use ridiculous analogies, and we're going to introduce some memorable characters to make this feel like a story, not a lecture. So let's start at the absolute beginning.
Sounds good.
Before we can talk about how to hedge, we have to understand why these markets even exist in the first place. Because, let's be honest, from the outside looking in, When the general public sees all those flashing red and green numbers on a screen and people screaming at each other in trading pits, they just assume it's a giant unregulated casino.
Yeah, the public perception heavily leans toward that idea. They think commodity markets are just, you know, institutional gambling.
Totally.
But for the commercial players, the actual businesses producing and consuming the physical goods that keep the entire world running, it really couldn't be further from the truth.
Right, it's not a game to them.
No, for them, hedging is not about gambling at all. It's about survival. It is about systematically removing risk from their business. And to understand how they actually do this, we first need to define the two parallel dimensions that are constantly interacting here.
Okay, lay it on me.
We have the cash market and we have the futures market.
Okay, I can take the cash market. So the sources also refer to this as the spot market or sometimes the physical market.
Right. Those are all interchangeable terms on the exam.
Got it. So this is the real world. This is the dirt under your fingernails. It's semi-trucks barreling down the highway. It's massive steel warehouses. This is where physical stuff actually physically changes hands.
Exactly. Tangible goods.
It's literal barrels of crude oil sloshing around, actual bushels of golden wheat. When you, the listener, go to the grocery store and buy a bag of flour, you are interacting with the absolute tail end of the cash market.
That is a perfect visualization. The cash market is reality. Then, layered right on top of that reality, you have the futures market.
The financial realm.
Exactly. It consists of paper contracts, or, well, entirely digital contracts these days, where two parties basically agree to buy or sell a highly standardized quantity and quality of that physical stuff, but at a highly specific later date for a price they agree upon today.
Okay, wait, let me pause you there. So, if the cash market is actual trucks and dirt, and the futures market is just like digital promises sitting on some computer server in Chicago, why on earth do they interact at all?
That's a very fair question.
Like, if I am a farmer driving a massive combine harvester in Nebraska, why do I care what some digital contract says on a screen? How does a digital promise actually protect my physical reality in the dirt?
That is the million-dollar question for the exam.
Yeah.
And it all comes down to one fundamental, completely unbreakable economic rule.
Okay, what's the rule?
Cash prices and futures prices for the exact same commodity tend to move together. They're intrinsically linked.
Like they're tied with a rope.
Yes. When the physical price of wheat in the real world falls, the futures price of wheat on the financial screen almost always falls right along with it. When one spikes up, the other spikes up.
Okay, but let's slow down and explain the why behind that. Because they don't just magically move together out of, like, sympathy for each other. There's an actual mechanism.
Right. They are tied together by the reality of arbitrage. And arbitrage is driven purely by supply and demand.
Okay, walk me through that.
So think about it logically. Let's say, for some bizarre reason, the physical cash price of wheat in the real world just dropped to $4 a bushel.
Okay, $4 in the real world.
But the futures contract for wheat that expires next month is stubbornly sitting way up at $6 a bushel on the screen.
Oh, wait. So there is just a massive $2 gap between reality and the financial screen.
Exactly. There's a huge discrepancy. Now, if you are a savvy, lightning-fast trader, what do you do?
I mean, I'd want to take advantage of that.
You absolutely do. You immediately go out and buy the physical wheat in the real world for $4. And at that exact same second, you sell a futures contract, promising to deliver that exact same wheat next month for $6.
Whoa. So you just locked in a totally risk-free guaranteed profit of $2 per bushel.
Right, minus maybe a few pennies for storing the physical wheat for a month. But yeah, it's basically free money.
Okay, I see where this is going. And because traders absolutely love free money, they aren't just going to do this once. They will do this on a massive scale.
Oh, on an industrial scale.
Yeah.
And what happens when thousands of aggressive traders suddenly start buying millions of bushels of physical wheat at $4?
Well, all that crazy buying demand is going to push the physical cash price up.
Exactly. And what happens when those exact same thousands of traders simultaneously sell millions of futures contracts at $6?
All that selling pressure on the screen pushes the futures price down.
Precisely. So the physical price gets pushed up, the futures price gets pushed down, and they aggressively squeeze together until that $2 gap completely disappears and the free money vanishes.
That is fascinating.
Right. That mechanism is exactly why cash and futures prices are locked in a permanent dance. They must move together because the second they drift apart, traders jump in and force them back in line.
Okay, so because we know for a fact they move together, You can use one to perfectly balance out the other. Which brings us to the golden rule of hedging.
Let's hear it.
I want you, the listener, to burn this into your brain right now. A hedge is taking a futures position that is mathematically opposite to your cash market position.
Opposite is the key word there.
The entire goal here is that a loss in the real world is perfectly offset by a gain on the futures screen. You are intentionally engineering a scenario where a negative financial event in your physical business is completely neutralized by a positive financial event in your financial portfolio.
Yeah, the sources often use this fire insurance analogy here. Like, you buy insurance hoping your house doesn't burn down, but if it does, you get a check.
Yeah, I've heard that one. It's okay for explaining what hedging is, but it doesn't really explain how the math actually works, you know?
Fair point.
Let's use a different analogy for our ADHD brains. Think of your business as a massive balance scale, or like a playground seesaw.
Okay, seesaw.
On one side of the seesaw, you have your physical, real-world business, the dirt, the tractors, the actual crops. On the other side of the seesaw, you have your digital futures trading account.
Mm.
Now, if global prices move against you, it's like a massive, super heavyweight of financial loss gets dropped right onto the physical side of your seesaw. Your business just starts plummeting toward the ground.
But, and here's where the magic happens. Because you set up a hedge, which we define as an opposite position,
yeah,
that exact same global price movement simultaneously drops an equally massive weight of financial gain onto the future side of your seesaw.
Yes. Exactly. So the heavyweight on the physical side pulls you down, but the heavyweight of cash on the future side pushes you right back up.
And the seesaw stays perfectly level.
Right. Your business doesn't crash into the dirt. You maintain your balance. And this is so important. You aren't doing this to rocket into the sky and make some massive profit. Yeah. You are doing it purely to ensure the seesaw never slams into the ground and breaks.
Which perfectly defines our primary player in this market. The exam is going to aggressively test your ability to differentiate the underlying motivations of the different market participants.
Okay, so who are the players?
First, we have the hedger. A hedger has a genuine, undeniable commercial interest in the physical commodity. They are the actual farmer, the miner, the baker, the airline.
The people dealing with the real stuff.
Right. They actually own the stuff, produce the stuff, or desperately need to buy the stuff just to keep their lights on. Their primary motivation, their only real motivation, is price certainty.
They just want to know what the math is going to be.
Exactly. They will willingly, happily trade away the chance at some massive speculative windfall just to lock in a known predictable price so they can actually plan their budgets and, you know, sleep at night.
That makes total sense. But they need someone to trade with, right?
Mm.
So on the other side of that transaction, we have to introduce our first recurring character for this deep dive.
Oh, I like this guy.
We're going to call him Speculator Spence.
Speculator Spence. Perfect.
Now, picture Spence. He is sitting in this hyper-modern, climate-controlled, glass-walled office in Chicago or New York. He is wearing a $5,000 tailored suit.
He's got three monitors on his desk.
At least three. Now, Spence has absolutely zero interest in physical commodities. Like, if an actual dump truck full of physical soybeans dumped its cargo into his pristine office lobby, he would literally have a panic attack.
He wouldn't know what to do with it.
Exactly. He doesn't own a farm. He doesn't own a bakery. Spence takes on price risk purely, 100% in pursuit of profit.
He has no offsetting cash position in the real world. He doesn't even own a seesaw.
Right. No seesaw for Spence.
He is just looking at weather patterns in Brazil. He's reading geopolitical news, he's studying chart trends, and he is trying to predict which way prices will go. He is making a directional bet to make money.
But the crucial thing here is that Spence isn't, like, the villain in this story. The hedgers actually really need him, don't they?
Oh, they absolutely rely on him. Spence provides the liquidity.
Right. He's the guy taking the other side.
Exactly. When a terrified farmer wants to offload the massive risk of a price crash, Spence is the guy standing there saying, hey, I'll take that risk off your hands because my charts say prices are actually going to go up. He absorbs the danger the hedger wants to get rid of, but his motivation is entirely speculative.
Okay, listener, it is time for a direct question to you. Pause whatever you're doing right now. If you are washing dishes, put the plate down. If you're walking the dog, stop walking.
Listen up.
Think about this scenario. If an exam question presents a massive commercial farming operation and asks you, what is the primary objective of this hedger? Pause for a beat. Now, if your brain just defaulted to saying maximizing their profit margin, I want you to literally slap your wrist.
Seriously, slap it.
The answer is always, invariably, risk reduction. It is securing price certainty. Profit maximization is for Spence, not the hedger.
And if you are sitting in the testing center, this is exactly where the test writers are going to try to set a very specific trap for you. It's a classic exam trick.
Oh, tell me how they set it up.
They will describe a hedger who successfully locks in a price using futures.
Yeah.
Okay. But then they will describe the global market moving in this massive, unexpected direction that would have made the hedger an absolute fortune if they had just stayed unhedged and sold their crop on the open market.
Oh, man.
Then the question will ask you to evaluate the effectiveness of that hedge. And they will always offer an answer choice that says something like, the hedge failed because it resulted in lost opportunity.
That is so incredibly sneaky, because human nature and just basic greed looks at that scenario and says, man, they missed out on like $2 million of extra profit because they hedged. What a disaster. The hedge definitely failed.
Right. It feels like a failure emotionally.
Yeah.
But analytically, from an economic standpoint, it is a complete success.
How so?
In the eyes of the exam and the reality of commercial economics, trading away that upside potential is not a failure. It is the literal cost of certainty.
I see.
If the hedger locked in the exact price they needed to cover their massive loans, made all their staff, and keep their business totally solvent, then the hedge succeeded flawlessly. You cannot let the illusion of missed speculative profit trick you into calling a fundamentally sound hedge a failure.
That is such a good reframe. Okay, so we know hedging is all about avoiding disaster and keeping the seesaw balanced, but I mean, the term disaster is totally relative in this market, isn't it?
Completely relative.
Like, what mathematically ruins one business might actually be an absolute dream scenario for another business. So let's look at exactly what an unhedged nightmare actually looks like for two very different commercial operations.
Yeah, being in an unhedged position basically means you are operating your business entirely exposed to the raw, unfiltered whims of global supply and demand. You have no futures contracts balancing your seesaw.
You're just naked in the wind.
Basically. You are fully exposed to whichever specific price swing mathematically destroys your specific business model.
Okay, to really visualize this, we are going to introduce two main commercial characters for this deep dive. Let's start with our first one, Farmer Fiona.
Farmer Fiona, got it.
Picture Fiona out in the hot sun. She runs this massive, sprawling corn farming operation. And let's put some real numbers to her reality to make it stick. It's late summer. She has literal steel silos full of physical corn sitting on her property right this second. Let's say 3 million bushels.
That's a huge operation.
It is. Now, in the formal, rigid language of the exam, Fiona is long the cash market, because she actually owns the physical commodity.
I really want to emphasize that phrase for the listener, long the cash market.
Why is that so important?
Because it means she physically possesses or is actively in the process of producing the underlying asset. That is her unchangeable starting reality. She's long physical corn.
Okay, so now let's build Fiona's nightmare scenario. Imagine her sitting at her kitchen table at like 2 a.m. She is staring at her ledger, drinking cold coffee, and she is sweating.
Why is she sweating?
Because she owes the local bank millions of dollars. She has fleets of John Deere tractors. She buys genetically modified seeds. She buys literal tons of fertilizer. What is keeping her awake at night? It's the terrifying mathematical reality that before she can get her 3 million bushels of corn loaded onto trains and sold to the global market, the global price of corn could absolutely plummet.
Let's run the exact math of her fear just to see how fast she gets wiped out. Let's say she needs to sell her corn for at least $4.50 a bushel just to break even and pay the bank back.
Okay, $4.50 is the magic number.
Her silos hold 3 million bushels. If the global price drops by just one single dollar down to $3.50 a bushel, she instantly loses $3 million of expected revenue.
Oof, gone.
Gone.
Yeah.
And her bank loans don't magically decrease just because the price of corn dropped in South America.
Right. The bank doesn't care. They still owe the same amount of money.
Exactly. So if prices crash, her entire livelihood just vanishes. The physical corn sitting in her silo suddenly isn't worth enough to cover her massive debts, and the bank just swoops in and forecloses on her farm. So to summarize, Fiona is absolutely terrified of falling prices.
Okay, so that is Fiona's nightmare. Now let's contrast her unhedged nightmare with our second recurring character, We're going to call him Bread Baker Barry.
Bread Baker Barry. I love it.
Barry runs a massive industrial-scale bakery operation. We're talking thousands and thousands of loaves of bread rolling off conveyor belts every single hour.
Smells great in there, I bet.
Oh, amazing. But here is the catch. Barry does not own a wheat farm. He doesn't have massive silos full of harvested wheat sitting out back. But because he has these ironclad contracts to supply cheap bread to massive supermarket chains, he must buy massive quantities of physical wheat in exactly 3 months to keep his ovens running.
Okay, so if Fiona is long the cash market because she owns it, what is Barry's official position in exam terms?
Well, the sources say he holds a short cash position.
Yes. And you will also frequently see the exam sources refer to this as an anticipated cash position.
Anticipated. Because he anticipates buying it.
Exactly. He does not currently own the physical wheat, but his entire business model makes him fundamentally, unavoidably committed to buying it in the near future. He is short physical wheat.
Okay, so let's picture Barry and his industrial bakery. It's loud, the ovens are blasting heat, and he's pacing the floor looking at his quarterly budget. What is his nightmare?
Got to be the exact opposite of Fiona's, right?
100%. If the price of wheat rallies, like if a massive drought in Europe causes global wheat prices to absolutely skyrocket by $2 a bushel before he has to make his purchase, his flour budget totally blows up.
And he cannot just magically pass that extra cost onto the consumer immediately, can he?
No. His contracts with those huge supermarkets dictate the price of his bread months in advance. If his raw material costs double overnight, his profit margins don't just shrink, they go profoundly negative. He would literally be losing money on every single loaf of bread he bakes. Yeah, if prices rise, his business goes totally bankrupt. Barry is terrified of rising prices.
So we have Fiona, who is long the physical commodity, and she is dreading a price drop. And we have Barry, who is short the physical commodity, and he is dreading a price rise.
Exactly. All right, listener, I'm throwing this direct question right at you again. Visualize Fiona staring at her massive silos of corn and Barry staring at his completely empty flour bins. Who is mathematically terrified of prices dropping?
Give him a second to think.
Pause for a beat. It's Fiona, because she already owns it. Her entire net worth is tied up in the value of that physical pile of corn. If the pile loses value, she loses wealth. Barry doesn't care if prices drop. He'd love it. But Fiona is terrified.
And if you can really internalize that specific logic, you are going to avoid one of the most common devastating pitfalls that candidates face on this exam.
Oh, this is a big one.
You must always, always match the hedger's fear to their underlying cash position. You do not match their fear to a speculative market opinion.
Wait, expand on that. How do the test raters try to trick you with market opinion?
They will construct a scenario specifically designed to distract your ADHD brain. They might say something like, Farmer Fiona, who currently holds 1 million bushels of soybeans, reads a highly credible agricultural report predicting that soybean prices are going to absolutely skyrocket to record highs over the next 3 months.
Okay, so they feed you this really bullish market opinion.
Right. They do that to make you think that Fiona suddenly wants to structure her portfolio to profit from this incoming rally.
But that's a total trap, isn't it? Because Fiona isn't a speculator like Spence. She isn't trying to predict a market crash or a market rally to make extra cash.
Exactly. It does not matter what the agricultural report says. It doesn't matter what Jim Cramer says on TV. It does not matter what Fiona personally thinks the market will do.
Right.
Her hedging strategy is dictated entirely by what she fundamentally fears the market will do, based on what she already physically owns. She fears a drop because a drop ruins her farm. Barry fears a rally because a rally ruins his bakery. Their actions are purely defensive, not predictive.
That is such a vital distinction. They aren't trying to outsmart the market. They are just trying to build a big, thick financial wall around their businesses. So let's look at the actual architectural blueprints for those walls.
Let's do it.
Let's dive deep into Fiona's playbook first. We establish she is terrified of a price drop because she's sitting on a literal mountain of corn. How exactly does she use futures contracts to protect herself? This brings us to the mechanics of the short hedge.
The short hedge is the ultimate defensive maneuver for protecting what you already possess. So let's walk through the mechanics step by step, and let's attach some concrete math to it to prove that the seesaw actually balances.
Okay, step one.
Step one. Fiona already owns the physical corn, so her cash position is long.
Check.
Step two. Because she is long cash, she fundamentally fears a price decline.
Check.
Step three. To build her defense, she takes the exact opposite position in the futures market. She sells futures contracts.
Okay, let's stop right there and run the conceptual math on the seesaw because I need to see this work. Let's say it's July. Fiona's absolute worst-case scenario actually materializes. Some massive, unforeseen global event causes the cash price of corn to completely plummet from $5 a bushel down to $3 a bushel.
A huge $2 drop.
Right. In the cash market, in the dirt of the real world, Fiona is devastated. The physical inventory she desperately needs to sell just lost $2 per bushel in value. The physical side of her seesaw just slammed violently into the ground. How on earth does the fact that she sold some digital futures contracts back in July save her actual farm in October?
It's brilliant. Follow the money through the two interconnected markets. Remember our golden rule from earlier? Cash and futures prices always move together because of that arbitrage mechanism we talked about.
Right, they're tied with a rope.
Exactly. So when the physical cash price of corn plummeted by $2, the futures price of corn on the financial screen also plummeted by $2.
Okay, they both dropped.
Now let's look at Fiona's futures account. Back in July, when prices were sitting high, she sold futures contracts at $5 a bushel. She essentially made a legally binding digital promise to deliver corn at $5.
Got it.
Now it's October. To close out her obligation in the financial market, she doesn't actually load up a train and deliver physical corn to Chicago.
No, nobody actually delivers the corn.
Right, she just offsets her position by buying back the exact same amount of futures contracts. But, and here's the key, because the entire market crashed, she gets to buy those contracts back at the new, much lower price of $3.
Oh, I see it. She sold the contracts at $5 and she bought them back at $3. She just made a $2 per bushel profit on the futures screen.
Exactly. Her short futures position generated a massive financial gain. So let's look at the whole picture now. Yes, her physical inventory lost $2 per bushel in value. That is a brutal reality. But that physical loss is perfectly mathematically offset by the $2 per bushel gain she just made in her digital futures account.
So the financial gain totally absorbs the physical loss. The heavy weight of cash on the future side of the seesaw pushes her business right back up to level ground.
You got it.
So what is the actual net real-world result for Fiona when all the dust settles and she cashes out?
The net result is that Fiona effectively locked in a selling price of $5 a bushel months in advance. She took the terrifying, chaotic uncertainty of the global market and just swapped it for a known fixed price.
When you lay out the math like that, it makes perfect sense. It's almost elegant. So if we are scanning a big paragraph question on the exam, who are the typical commercial entities that act exactly like Fiona?
Yeah.
Who are the classic short hedgers we need to look for?
You're looking for any business entity that currently owns, produces, or is holding a physical commodity as inventory. So clearly, farmers with crops growing in the field.
Sure, that's easy.
But it also includes huge mining corporations that are pulling copper or gold out of the dirt.
Yeah.
It includes ranchers who have thousands of head of cattle sitting in a feedlot just gaining weight before they are sold to a meatpacking plant.
Oh, that makes sense. They're long cattle.
Exactly. It even includes massive commercial grain elevators and warehouses that buy grain and hold it in storage before passing it down the supply chain. If they possess the physical goods, they are long cash, they fear a price drop, and they will invariably use a short hedge.
Okay, I want to pause and push back on the terminology here for a second, because this is where a lot of people, honestly, myself included, can get really mentally tangled up.
Let's untangle it.
Let's take the farming example. Farming, at its absolute core, is a business of creating something in order to sell it for a profit, right? You buy seeds cheap, you apply a ton of labor, you grow the crop, and you sell it for more than you spent.
Right. That's the whole business model.
It feels like the ultimate long business model. You want things to grow and values to increase. So why on earth do we define her primary hedging action as a short hedge? Like, the word shorting in finance usually implies you are betting against a company or betting against an industry. It sounds like she's betting against her own livelihood.
Yes. It is one of the absolute most common points of cognitive dissonance for students taking this exam. You have to firmly separate the overall arc of her business from the specific financial mechanism she is using in that exact moment.
Okay, how do I do that?
Look at the timeline. By the time that corn is growing in the field, or sitting harvested in the silo, it is already hers. She has already spent the money to create it. Her bank account literally shrinks if global prices fall, simply by the act of holding those physical goods.
Right, her net worth is dropping every day the price drops.
Exactly. Her core exposure to the market is unequivocally long. Therefore, to neutralize that exposure, she must take the mathematically opposite position in the financial market. She must short futures.
Okay, and this is where we have to flag a major, major conceptual trap for the exam. Listen up, guys. The word short in the phrase short hedge only refers to the specific mechanical action she took in the futures market. It simply means she sold futures contracts. It does not mean her overall business exposure is short. She is actually long the physical commodity. And it absolutely, positively does not mean she is making a bearish, speculative bet that the agricultural market is going to crash.
That is so critical.
She is not speculator Spence. She is not betting against corn. She was just buying her fire insurance. She is balancing her seesaw.
That is the perfect way to categorize it. She is merely locking in a selling price to ensure her survival. And understanding Fiona's defense perfectly sets up the mirror image of this scenario. Now we need to look at how our other character, Bread Baker Barry, survives his specific nightmare.
Exactly. Because we just walked through how Fiona locks in a selling price by selling futures. But Barry is terrified of the exact opposite economic event. He doesn't have silos of grain to sell. He has totally empty flour bins that he must fill. This brings us to the mechanics of the long hedge.
The long hedge is the ultimate financial tool for putting a hard ceiling on your future costs. So let's walk through Barry's mechanics step by step, just like we did for Fiona. Step one. Barry needs to buy physical wheat in 3 months to keep his massive bakery running. So his cash position is short or anticipated.
Check.
Step two. Because he must buy later, he mathematically fears a price rise.
Check.
Step three. To build his defense, he takes the opposite position in the futures market. He buys futures contracts.
Okay, I am going to demand the conceptual math again to prove it works on the seesaw.
Wow.
Barry wakes up in September, turns on the morning news, and sees that terrible, unprecedented droughts have completely destroyed the wheat crops across the entire northern hemisphere.
A total disaster for wheat.
Global wheat prices absolutely skyrocket overnight. They jump from $6 a bushel all the way to $8 a bushel. Now, Barry's physical flour bill is going to be astronomical. It is going to wipe out his profit margins and bankrupt his bakery. How does the fact that he bought a few digital futures contracts 3 months ago save him today?
Again, follow the tight linkage between the two markets. The physical cash price just went through the roof, meaning Barry has to pay an absolute fortune to his suppliers for the physical wheat. The physical side of his seesaw is heavily loaded down with the weight of massive increased costs.
Right, he's sinking.
But remember, the futures price goes up in perfect tandem with the cash price. Back in June, when prices were nice and low and stable, Barry bought futures contracts at $6 a bushel.
Right.
He secured a digital promise to buy at $6. Now, to close his position in the financial market, he sells those exact same contracts back to the market at today's sky-high price of $8.
Oh, he bought low and sold high on the futures screen.
Yes, he did. His long futures position generated a massive gain of $2 per bushel. So he takes that financial gain from his futures account, cashes it out into real dollars, and uses that money to pay the extra astronomical cost to his physical wheat suppliers.
Wow.
The financial gain completely absorbs the extra cash cost. The heavy weight of cash on the future side completely balances the seesaw.
Meaning, when you factor in the massive futures profit he just made, he essentially pays the exact same net amount he would have paid back in June. He successfully locked in an approximate purchase price.
Exactly. He put a hard, impenetrable ceiling on his raw material costs.
But I want to spend a minute highlighting the psychological trade-off here, because this is where the philosophy of hedging gets so interesting. And this is exactly where the exam tries to trick you about whether a hedge fails.
The trade-off is everything.
That protective ceiling Barry just built, it is bought at the price of a floor. Let's flip Barry's scenario entirely to see what happens. Let's say Barry buys his futures contracts at $6, locking in his nice safe price. But over the next 3 months, global weather is absolutely perfect. It's a massive bumper crop.
Wheat everywhere.
Right. Wheat prices totally crash. They drop to historic lows of $4 a bushel. Now, unhedged bakers across the country are throwing parties because their flour is practically free. They are making record profits on every loaf of bread. But what about Barry?
Barry does not get to join that party. Barry still ends up paying a net cost right around his locked-in price of $6.
Let's explain why, because it's a little counterintuitive. If cash prices crash to $4, yes, he gets to buy the physical wheat from his supplier dirt cheap. But UT, his futures contracts, which he bought for $6, also completely crashed in value.
Right, they dropped to $4, too.
So to close his position, he has to sell them back at $4, taking a massive $2 loss per bushel in his futures account. So he has to take all the real money he saved on the cheap physical wheat and use it to cover his margin calls and pay off his massive losses on the futures screen.
This is the fundamental unbreakable deal that every single true hedger accepts. He traded away the chance at a windfall for the ironclad guarantee of certainty. He doesn't get to participate in the lucky break of a price crash, but he also guarantees his business won't go bankrupt from a sudden price spike. That is the true price of stability.
Now, in the study materials, there's just a specific term used for this that sounds highly technical, but it's actually quite simple. The sources call it an anticipatory hedge. I can deduce this one, I think. Based on the name alone, this has to be exactly what Barry is doing, right? He is protecting a purchase he anticipates making in the future.
You deduced it perfectly. It is literally just a forward-looking alias for a long hedge.
That's it. Just a different name.
That's it. The exam writers will sometimes use anticipatory hedge in a question stem just to see if they can rattle your confidence. They want you to think it's a whole new concept. When you see that phrase, just picture Bread Baker Barry.
Yeah.
It is just another name for having a short cash position and buying futures to protect it.
Good to know. So when the exam asks you to identify typical long hedgers, who are we looking for in the vast commercial landscape?
You are looking for any business that consumes a raw commodity as an input to create a finished product.
Okay, like who?
Processors, like massive grain mills turning raw wheat into flour, or huge food companies turning raw corn into breakfast cereal. Manufacturers, like an industrial jeweler who constantly needs to buy physical gold to make watches.
Got it.
It also includes exporters who have signed big contracts promising to deliver goods abroad at a fixed price in 6 months, but who haven't actually bought the physical goods to fulfill that order yet. They are short the physical goods.
Okay, listener, direct question time again. Think fast on this one. Let's say a major global airline knows it is going to need 10 million gallons of jet fuel in exactly 6 months to keep its massive fleet in the sky. Are they in Fiona's position or are they in Barry's position?
TikTok.
Pause for a beat. They are Barry. They do not own the jet fuel yet. They have to buy the physical commodity later. Therefore, they are terrified of fuel prices rising. They are long hedgers. They must buy futures today to lock in their future fuel costs.
And that airline example perfectly highlights how the exam tries to trick you with categorization. The test writers absolutely love to use processors or manufacturers to scramble your brain.
How so?
Well, they might describe a massive, sprawling food processing plant that, quote, produces millions of boxes of breakfast cereal every year. Your brain keys in on the word produces or makes, and you might subconsciously associate them with Farmer Fiona, the producer, assuming they need a short hedge.
Oh, because they're creating a product to sell. That is a devious trick.
It is super devious. But you have to look at their relationship to the raw commodity being traded on the futures exchange. They are not producing the raw corn or the raw wheat. They are buying the raw corn to manufacture the cereal.
They are consumers of the raw material.
Exactly. They buy raw inputs. Therefore, an increase in the price of raw corn hurts their margins. A processor or a manufacturer is almost always a long hedger. Furthermore, do not let the phrase anticipatory hedge trick you into thinking it's some separate, highly complex, magical third strategy. It is just a long hedge. It involves buying futures, period.
Okay, let's take a deep breath. We have analyzed Fiona's defense strategy in total isolation, and we've analyzed Barry's defense strategy in total isolation. We know the math, we know the mechanics, we know the seesaw.
We've got the pieces.
Now we are going to violently smash them together. Because the exam is rarely going to ask you about one in total isolation. It loves to test your ability to quickly distinguish between them under the intense pressure of a ticking clock.
The comparative analysis is absolutely where candidates usually drop points. The concepts start blurring together, the long and short terminology gets totally flipped, and panic just sets in.
So pattern interrupt right here. I am breaking the fourth wall. If you are walking the dog, if you are doing the dishes, I want you to literally stop moving for 30 seconds, look at a blank wall or just close your eyes and visualize this comparison table we're about to build, because this is the single most testable concept in this entire unit. We are going into the matrix drill.
The matrix drill, let's do it.
We are going to repeat everything we just learned, but from a strictly comparative angle. Build this grid in your head.
I will walk through the side-by-side comparison feature by feature. Let's start with the foundational reality, the cash position.
Okay. On the left side of your mental matrix, we have Farmer Fiona. Her cash position is long the physical. She owns it in her silos. On the right side, we have bread baker Barry. His cash position is short or anticipated. He does not own it, but he absolutely must buy it later.
Good. Now, moving down the matrix,
yeah.
What is their primary underlying fear?
Fiona, on the left, fears prices will fall before she can sell her corn. Barry, on the right, fears prices will rise before he can buy his wheat.
Which logically dictates their required futures action. What do they do?
To protect herself and balance the seesaw, Fiona executes a short hedge. She sells futures contracts today. To protect himself, Barry executes a long hedge. He buys futures contracts today.
And finally, what is the ultimate economic result? What does the strategy actually lock in?
Fiona's short hedge mathematically locks in an approximate selling price. Barry's long hedge mathematically locks in an approximate purchase price.
That is the entire matrix. If you can clearly rebuild that simple grid in your mind during the exam, you can systematically dismantle almost any practical hedging question they throw at you.
Let's test that theory right now. Direct question to you, the listener. Let's see if we can rebuild the entire logic path from just one single piece of information. Let's say an exam question starts by telling you a commercial business is a grain elevator currently holding 200,000 bushels of inventory in storage.
Stop her there.
Yes, stop reading the question right there. What is their cash position? Pause for a beat. They are holding physical inventory, so they are long the physical cash market.
Right.
Next logical step. Because they are long the physical, what economic event do they fear?
Think about the seesaw.
Pause for a beat. They fear falling prices because their stored inventory would lose value. Mm-hmm. Okay, final step. Because they fear falling prices, what futures action must they take to balance the seesaw? Pause for a beat. They must sell futures. Boom. They are using a short hedge. You just logically derive the entire correct answer without having to rely on a single memorized flashcard.
That is exactly how you beat this exam. You build the unbreakable logic chain. The cash position dictates the fear. The fear dictates the future's action. But listen closely, because here is exactly how they try to break your chain. The classic exam trap is simply flipping the terminology.
How do they flip it?
The test will try to mix up the action in the futures market with the position in the cash market. They want you to confuse short cash with short hedge. You must always remember that the future side perfectly mirrors the cash side in reverse.
What's a really good sticky mental shortcut for that mirroring effect? If a candidate is panicking and the clock is ticking, what is a simple phrase they can fall back on?
Think of it like this. Match the futures action today to the physical cash transaction they are worried about making in the future. A seller to be someone like Fiona, who will eventually sell physical goods in the real world, later sells futures now. A buyer to be someone like Barry, who will eventually buy physical goods in the real world, later buys futures now. Seller sells, buyer buys. It is perfectly, elegantly symmetrical.
Wait, that is so clean. Seller sells today, buyer buys today. I love that. It's so simple. It's basically impossible to mess up under pressure.
Exactly. Just remember, seller sells, buyer buys.
Okay, let's zoom out a bit. Fiona and Barry have successfully executed their hedges, they have locked in their prices, they've neutralized their risks, and they have saved their businesses from the chaotic whims of global supply and demand.
They're safe.
But this brings us to a massive, almost existential question about the big picture of this whole ecosystem. What does all this buying and selling of digital futures contracts actually do to the real world? Like, why do governments, economists, and regulators absolutely love that these markets exist?
Because it fundamentally changes how risk is distributed across the entire global economy, and it creates a highly efficient, transparent system for determining what raw materials are actually worth. Let's break that down into two distinct economic functions that the exam will definitely ask you about: the transfer of risk and price discovery.
Let's start with the risk part, because a foundational rule of physics and, you know, finance is that risk doesn't just magically vanish into thin air, right?
Never.
When Fiona executes her short hedge and sells futures to protect against a price drop, that underlying risk of a global price drop didn't get deleted from the universe. The danger is still out there.
Exactly. Risk cannot be destroyed. It can only be transferred. And this is where our old friend, speculator Spence, re-enters the narrative in a truly crucial way. Hedging essentially transfers price risk away from the commercial firms, the Fionas and the Barrys, who are just trying to run physical, job-creating businesses, and dumps it squarely onto the tailored shoulders of speculators like Spence.
Because Spence is willingly, eagerly taking the exact opposite side of their trades in pursuit of a massive profit.
Precisely. When Fiona sells thousands of corn futures contracts to lock in her price, Who is on the other side of that digital trade actually buying them? It is usually not another commercial hedger. It is Spence. Spence looks at his highly complex technical charts, analyzes global weather patterns, firmly believes corn prices are going to go up, and says, I will buy those contracts. He absorbs the risk of prices falling completely willingly because he is chasing the speculative upside.
So if you step back and look at it, society basically built this brilliant financial system where the vulnerable businesses that actually produce our food, our energy, and our raw materials can offload all their financial anxiety onto Wall Street traders who are actively asking for it.
That is a slightly colorful way to phrase it, but economically, you are entirely correct. It makes the commercial supply chain incredibly stable and resilient.
Give me an example of the macro impact.
Think about it. Because Fiona hedged, she doesn't go bankrupt when South America floods the global corn market. Because she didn't go bankrupt, she is still farming next year. Because she is farming next year, there is still a stable supply of food in the grocery store, and all her farmhands keep their jobs. The systemic shock of that price crash is completely absorbed by speculators who are heavily capitalized specifically to handle those massive losses.
Okay, that makes total sense. It acts as a giant shock absorber for the real economy. But what about that second function you mentioned? You called it price discovery. Explain how that works, because it sounds a bit, I don't know, abstract.
Price discovery is perhaps the most vital, everyday function of the futures market. Think about the sheer mind-boggling volume of trades happening every single minute. Every single time Fiona and Spence agree on a price for a futures contract, that transaction isn't happening in some secret, smoky back room. It is instantly quoted on a public exchange for the entire world to see. It becomes completely democratized public information.
Right, like looking up the current price of Apple stock on your phone. Anyone can see it.
Yes, but instead of a tech company, this is the price of the raw materials that literally build the future of the world. When millions of commercial hedgers and speculators are constantly buying and selling based on real-time data, those quoted futures prices represent the market's collective, aggregated expectation of global supply and demand. It gives the whole world a shared, completely transparent read on what a commodity is fairly worth at any given second.
I've always thought of it like having a Kelley Blue Book for literally everything in the world, updated every millisecond.
That's a great analogy.
So if a random independent farmer in Nebraska wants to know if the local grain elevator is offering him a fair cash price for his soybeans today, he doesn't have to guess or just take their word for it. He just pulls out his smartphone and looks at the Chicago futures screen.
Exactly. That is the true essence of price discovery. The futures market discovers the fair, globally accepted price, and the physical cash market across the country uses that price as a baseline reference point. And this entire relationship is strictly enforced by a critical concept called convergence.
Convergence. Just by the root of the word, meaning things coming together. We touched on this briefly earlier with the arbitrage example.
We did. And it is absolutely vital to fully grasp how it works as a contract ages. As the delivery date of a futures contract approaches, as we move from a theoretical future date to the actual present day, the cash price in the real world and the futures price on the screen mathematically draw together. They converge until they're essentially identical on the exact day the contract expires.
Let's walk through exactly how arbitrage violently forces that convergence, because I want to make sure the mechanics are crystal clear for the exam. Let's say it's the final day of a wheat futures contract. The futures price is sitting at $7, but the physical cash price in the actual town where the delivery warehouse is located is only $6. What happens?
Arbitragers step in instantly, like within milliseconds.
Yeah.
A trader will immediately buy the physical cash wheat in the town for $6. They will simultaneously sell the expiring futures contract on the screen at $7.
Right, to lock in the gap.
Exactly. Because the contract is literally expiring today, they can just drive the physical wheat they just bought right over to the delivery warehouse, hand it over to fulfill their short futures contract obligation, and pocket a completely risk-free $1 profit per bushel.
And because they're doing this with millions of bushels all at once, their massive buying in the local town drives the $6 cash price up, and their massive selling on the futures exchange drives the $7 futures price down.
Exactly. The physical aggressive act of arbitrage violently forces the two prices to crash into each other until they are perfectly equal and all the free money is gone. Because of this mathematically guaranteed convergence, active hedging constantly feeds highly accurate, tested information into the cash market, stabilizing prices for everyone, even those who don't even trade futures.
Which is exactly why regulators and governments love this system so much. When functioning correctly, it's not a casino at all. It's an incredibly sophisticated pricing and stability mechanism that anchors the entire real economy.
And that leads to a really crucial warning for how you approach questions in this big picture section of the exam. The test writers will sometimes try to test your underlying economic philosophy regarding these markets.
How do they do that?
They might offer a multiple choice answer that frames routine commercial hedging as price distortion or market manipulation.
Oh, man. If you see those phrases applied to standard hedging, you cross that answer out immediately.
Immediately. From the strict perspective of the exam material and economic reality, bona fide hedging is always considered economically constructive. It stabilizes the market. Furthermore, remember our point about the transfer of risk. If an answer choice claims that a hedge eliminates risk from the market entirely, that statement is blatantly false.
Because the risk didn't evaporate.
Exactly. It still exists. It's just sitting in Spence's portfolio now instead of Fiona's. It is transferred, never eliminated.
Transferred, never eliminated. That is a fantastic distinction to keep in your back pocket for test day. All right, we have covered an immense amount of ground today. We have completely deconstructed the absolute core philosophy of hedging theory. We spent quality time with Farmer Fiona, Bread Baker Barry, and our guy Speculator Spence.
Spence the legend.
We've built the matrix drill in our heads, and we've explored the massive macroeconomic impact of price discovery and convergence. Now it is time to cement it all in. Instead of just reading down a boring list, let's do this organically. I am going to try to summarize the five absolute most important takeaways from this entire deep dive in under 60 seconds. Consider this my final exam. You stop me and correct me if I miss a single nuance. Ready?
Let's see if the mental framework actually holds up. Go for it.
Okay, takeaway number one. The fundamental unchangeable goal of a hedger is risk reduction and price certainty, not maximizing profit. You achieve this balance by taking a futures position that is exactly mathematically opposite to your physical cash position. A real-world loss is perfectly offset by a futures gain.
Spot on. The seesaw remains perfectly level. Next.
Number two. If you currently own the physical commodity or are in the active process of producing it, you are long cash. Your ultimate nightmare is a price drop. To protect yourself, you execute a short hedge by selling futures contracts today. This locks in your approximate selling price. Think of Farmer Fiona guarding her silos.
Correct. Defending what you already have. Number three.
Number three. If you desperately need to buy a physical commodity later to keep your business running, your cash position is short or anticipated. Your nightmare is a price rise. To protect yourself, you execute a long hedge, which the exam might also sneakily call an anticipatory hedge by buying futures contracts today. This locks in your approximate purchase price. Think of Bread Baker Barry trying to put a hard ceiling on his flour costs.
Excellent. The ceiling versus the floor. Number four.
Number four is the mental trap. The words short and long in the name of the hedge strictly describe the mechanical action you take in the futures market today. They do not describe your overall business exposure, and they absolutely do not indicate a speculative directional bias on the market. Seller to be sells futures. Buyer to be buys futures.
Flawless logic chain. Seller sells, buyer buys. And the final point.
Number five, the players and the big picture. Hedgers hold real physical cash positions. They have a genuine commercial interest in the underlying commodity. Speculators like Spence do not. They are just chasing financial profit. By interacting, hedgers transfer their risk to the speculators, which creates massive liquidity, fuels real-time price discovery, and ultimately makes the global economy vastly more stable.
You passed with flying colors. That is the undeniable core of hedging theory. If you understand those 5 points, not just as memorized facts on a flashcard, but as logical, interconnected, mechanical gears, you are going to absolutely crush this heavily weighted section of the Series 3.
I feel like I could walk into the testing center right now and ace it. But before we sign off and let the listener get back to their practice exams on cert fuel, do you have any final thoughts?
Actually, yeah, I do. Before we sign off, I want to leave you with one final, slightly provocative puzzle to chew on while you review your notes tonight. It pushes everything we just learned one step further into the real messy world.
Ooh, I love a good puzzle. Lay it on us.
Throughout this entire deep dive, we've talked extensively about what happens when prices move strictly up or down, and we've treated producers and processors as totally separate, isolated entities.
Right.
We had Fiona way over here and Barry way over there.
Right.
But think about this. What if you are a massive commercial firm that does both? What if you are a sprawling vertically integrated conglomerate that grows its own literal fields of wheat, but also operates its own industrial bakeries to bake its own bread.
Oh, wow.
Your agricultural division is mathematically terrified of wheat prices falling, but your bakery division is mathematically terrified of wheat prices rising. Which side of the market are you actually exposed to? Are you a short hedger? Are you a long hedger? Or do you just end up having to hedge against yourself?
That is a phenomenal, totally mind-bending, real-world complication. I mean, how do you even balance the seesaw when you are your own supplier and your own consumer? It completely scrambles the math we just built.
It absolutely does. It requires an entirely different, incredibly complex level of corporate risk management that goes way beyond Fiona and Barry.
Man, that is definitely something to chew on while you review your notes and tackle those practice quizzes. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Keep grinding, trust the logic over the memorization, and we will catch you next time.